I want to get your take on the current occupation of Iraq. Things definitely aren't going as the administration had presented they would.
Yeah.
And even like a couple months in, I started seeing direct parallels with what you had covered in your book, Hideous Dream. It was almost like events coming right out of your book.
It's sort of interesting, but I mean, you know, an occupation is an occupation. And there are certain characteristics about imperial occupations that I think are universal, especially the relationship that ultimately is going to develop between the occupier and the occupied. People resent having a military occupation. I can't imagine why, but they do. And people who are in a position of the occupier also begin to resent the people who they are occupying. So that breakdown in the relationship is pretty much inevitable, and we're seeing it really, really quickly and with just a ferocious intensity in Iraq right now. People aren't even getting a fraction, I don't think, of the story of the kind of brutality that characterizes that relationship right now, because the press, I don't think craven is too strong a word for the way that it's been covered over there so far, the way that they cover up for a lot of what goes on. And that was one, I don't know if you saw it a while back, I did an open letter to the GIs over there and tell them, you know, it's going to be a struggle to hang on to your own humanity while you're in a situation like that. But the key to it is to recognize the humanity of those people that you're occupying. Because this is not just something that's real similar to what happened in Haiti. It's even more similar to what happened in Vietnam. People aren't just in a situation where they're antagonists. They begin to internalize that antagonism. And then the dehumanization begins, and then you end up with situations like they had in they've been having them almost every day, but, you know, every time anything happens now, the people on the scene say that the soldiers just open up at random. Apparently there's been a fair amount of brutality to people who are detainees as well. And, you know, you talk to the troops, and, you know, you'll hear it in the terminology that you use. They start talking about ragheads and hajis and whatnot. That's the first step. You know, you have to rename them as something that's other than and less than. And that's how it starts. And we'll see that coming back. We'll see a lot of that coming back with this massive rotation that's coming up. Well, it's in progress right now. They're already starting to bring. We're going to have 8,000 to 10,000 people brought right back here to Fort Bragg, close to where I live. In the next month, some of them are already starting to show up. The consequences of that, the psychological consequences of that, the social consequences of that are going to come back and be visited on families and communities. And even some physical consequences, because there's going to be people fall ill as a consequence of the stuff that they're being exposed to. Actual material environmental toxins over there as well. Not just the damage of post-traumatic stress disorder and the kind of personality fragmentation that happens when you're put in a situation like that, but a lot of things. So we're gonna begin to see the consequences, and we're already hearing about it through some of the military families.
Talk about that, if you would. You were one of the founding members, I believe, of Bring Them Home Now.
Yeah, I wasn't a member. I'm on the coordinating committee. That's really a campaign of two organizations. It's Military Families Speak Out, which is an organization of military families who are opposed to the Iraq War, and Veterans for Peace. And that identity is something that we're sort of jealous about guarding, because we feel like we have a special role to play in the anti-war movement as people who are part of what you might call a military community, not just because we have a special understanding of some of what's going on with the war and the kinds of impacts that it's going to have on the people who participate in it, but also because we have a certain immunity to the kind of criticisms that are leveled at other people who oppose the war. We want to question people's patriotism and, you know, all that other demagogic crap that they come out with, and we do have a level of immunity against that. And people tend to listen, for probably pretty sound reasons, to veterans and people coming out of military communities on questions of war and peace, because we have firsthand experience of it, as opposed to hearsay experience. So for all those reasons, we feel like that's a real important formation. The campaign itself, Bring Them Home Now, is an attempt between those two organizations, with some assistance from some legal backstopping and counseling from people like the National Lawyers Guild Military Law Task Force and the GI Rights Hotline, to reach out to more military families and through those military families to establish lines of communication to the people who are actually over there. That's part of it. And then the other part is an advocacy piece. You know, we're going to use that special credibility and that special immunity that we have to attack this administration for all the reasons it needs to be attacked. The last few days has just been emblematic of the way this whole thing has proceeded and the way it's been portrayed by the corporate press. We've got the Hutton inquiry where the British government absolves and exonerates the British government. You know, what a surprise. And now the Bush administration is going to appoint its own committee to look into allegations of intelligence failures. It's like, you know, this is George the dog ate my homework Bush. And the press is now running one story after another about why dogs eat homework. You see what I'm saying? And that's not what the deal is. It was not an intelligence failure. Scott Ritter's been around for a long time. He was the chief inspector over there. He told them years ago that the weapons were gone. They made that up so that they would have a pretext to go over there and invade. And the reason that they invaded Iraq is because Iraq has oil. And, I mean, that is such a no-brainer. But those types of things, for some reason, it's almost a violation of fundamental respectability for anybody in the corporate press to ask straightforward questions anymore. It's like, and it's not that they're being forced or disciplined to being as craven as they are. They do it without any pressure whatsoever. That's what I'm trying to understand, is why in the world no one would question the disingenuousness of President Bush. It wasn't like no one said before the war that these are pretexts. We all said that. And now it's like, well, it's an intelligence failure. It's almost like the old thing. I'm shocked that there's gambling going on in this establishment. I mean, you know, it's been almost a bizarre interlude in the last few weeks as the press has suddenly said, well, my God, there's no weapons over there, as if they were surprised about that. Not only are there no weapons over there, but even if there were, who in the world is the United States government to go around pointing fingers at anyone else for having weapons of mass destruction when we have the most destructive arsenal in the universe? I mean, you know, what is that about?
Yeah, it was amazing watching David Kaye before, I believe, was a Senate committee, saying pretty much what, almost word for word, what Scott Ritter had said, you know, months ago.
Yeah. Yeah, they wanted to try to find some way to personally discredit Scott Ritter because he wasn't following the script. For them to turn around and say this is an intelligence failure and that they didn't know any better. I mean, I'm trying to figure out how long the intelligence community is going to put up with this. I mean, I know that they can't just jump up and overthrow the boss, but I'm expecting in the next few months to start seeing some pretty damaging leaks come out of the intelligence community, because for all I would disagree probably with the majority of people who are intelligence professionals in the United States, these people are still professionals, and most of them, however deluded they may be about the nature of the United States government, I think are trying to do what they perceive to be the right thing. I think the majority of them are people that are doing that and take a little bit of pride in their professionalism, even though, like I say, I think they're on I think they're working for their instruments of imperialism the same as I was for 24 years. But, you know, they're going to get tired of being patsies. They're going to get tired of this administration every time they get caught with their hand in the cookie jar saying, you know, going out there and bend over. It's only a matter of time until the leaks start to happen. And they're not just going to come from the intelligence community. They're going to come from the military community, too. Because it's not just Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby and all these other Darth Vaders in the background who are using the intelligence community as patsies. It's a lunatic Donald Rumsfeld and the way that he's abused the military institution in this country, you know, as if it's his personal toy. He's really involved in the systematic institutional destruction of the military right now, and the people in the military know it. They know they're facing a recruitment and retention crisis. It's going to take them almost a generation to overcome some of the consequences of it. They know that, you know, but they can't speak out. But these are not stupid people. And by, they're going to get back at these folks. There's a lot of generals in the Pentagon right now who'd like to be saying the same thing about Donald Rumsfeld that I'm saying, but they can't. I guarantee you that's true.
Yeah, it seems that the Pentagon and those generals and people that work there traditionally are there from administration to administration, whereas any given administration like this particular one, Rumsfeld is really only in there for, let's say, 4 to a maximum of 8 years. It seems on some levels that the Pentagon would have an upper hand in this situation.
Yeah, well, you know, power is a funny thing. It tends to shift around from day to day as the circumstances change, you know, and everybody's always positioning. This administration has gotten themselves into a situation where they're in a war that they can't win, but they're in a situation politically where they can't leave. So, you know, they painted themselves into this corner. Now I want to see them get out. It would almost be funny, except that real human beings are losing their lives in the process. They cannot win this war. They can't. I say that categorically. They're in a situation where they simply cannot win it, because the success of military operations is not determined by tactical outcomes. It's determined by political outcomes. And the political outcome is already clear. It's a disaster. And it's not like wine, and it's not going to improve with age. You can see already the outlines of a social cataclysm coming in the face of this thing. In fact, the best thing that could happen for the Iraqi people right now would just be a summary withdrawal of all American troops. I think that would probably be the least destructive outcome. The longer they stay in there, the more that they're going to create situations where these ethnic conflicts are going to turn into full-blown civil wars. And we're even seeing splits now that are beginning to appear in the southern Shia populations, you know, between Sadr and Sistani and all that. And that's a direct consequence of the American presence there and everybody trying to position relative to the American presence. If the American presence wasn't there right now, it wouldn't take very long for people to organize some form of an election and to go forward. And in fact, Sistani and other people over there have already indicated that they're not interested in establishing some form of backward theocracy, because they know it won't be in their own interest. In fact, they've already expressed an interest in a federated, at least semi-secular government that's inclusive. They want to go back to the positive aspects of the situation before 1991, because we've all heard about the negatives, and you can have a lot of negative consequences whenever you have, you know, the West behind the scenes helping fan the flames of an incredibly destructive war between Iraq and Iran. But, you know, even in the face of all that, I mean, Saddam Hussein's biggest sins were not the gassing of the Kurds and all that. The United States supported that wholeheartedly. His sins were the Ba'athist accomplishments. It was the level of development that had been achieved. It was the establishment of universal free public education all the way through college. It was the establishment of a universal health care system and a comparatively high standard of living in the region. It was the accomplishments that were the sins, because it gave them the potential for establishing themselves as independent. And Arab nationalism has always been, you know, the boogeyman of the United States and Great Britain, because they don't believe in sovereignty. Not there. Not when you've got a patch of land the size of Indiana sitting on 60% of the world's easily accessible oil reserves. You know, not there. No sovereignty. That's what's going on. And anybody that's awake and not just practicing the most egregious form of self-delusion has to understand that that's the case.
How do you see as a possibility of the U.S. getting out of this war? Does Bring Them Home Now have any strategy for that? I know.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that people say, bring them home now. What do you mean now? What'll happen if we leave? And I do think that there just needs to be a summary withdrawal. But again, I'm also that aware that we're not just dealing with material reality, but political reality. Politically, I don't think anyone's going to be able to do that. That's why I say this is a real jam up. You've got a situation where you politically can't leave, and you can, but militarily you can't win. So what are you going to do? We got into this dilemma around 1965, and rather than resolve the dilemma and take the political hit. We ended up staying there until 3 million Southeast Asians were dead, 58,000 Americans were dead, and, oh, by the way, one of the biggest environmental catastrophes in human history was also accomplished, and lost anyway. So we're facing the same possibility in Iraq right now. And I don't think it's a responsibility of Euro-American forces to determine the futures of Arab and Muslim peoples. Yes, there probably will be some civil strife in the wake of an American withdrawal, but it'll be a lot less severe, and it'll be resolved a lot more quickly in the absence of an American occupation. The idea that the Americans have to stay there to prevent a civil war, first of all, is a caricature. There's no real indication that there's going to be widespread open civil war. In fact, the regions themselves are broken up into fairly homogeneous regions. The only place that might end up being a real hot potato is going to be northern Iraq around Iraqi Kurdistan, because there's such a rich patch of easily accessible oil right there, and it's also within sniffing distance of Turkey and Iran. But that situation is not going away just because there's a U.S. occupation there. The U.S. is in there attempting to establish permanent bases with which to control the region so they can dominate the flow of energy to Asia and Europe as current and future economic competitors. The problem is it's not working. So, you know, what we're saying is the solution is to get out now. How we do that, that's almost a mechanical problem. The first thing we want to talk about is we want the political decision to withdraw. That's what we're fighting for. We're fighting for the political decision to say, yes, we're leaving Iraq. And then we can talk about how to do it. A lot of times this business of, well, you know, how does it get accomplished? By diverting the argument to how it gets accomplished, we're missing the main point, which is we need the political decision to do it. How we do it is going to be a practical matter. My suggestion is with ships and airplanes.
I was somewhat surprised when I saw in the press, international press, that it was months back when the U.S. started literally picking up some of the tactics that Israelis use in Palestine. And then we see recently that now one of the terms that normally is attributed to Palestine, Israel, the suicide bomber, is a commonplace thing there in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there's some differences now. There's some differences between the American occupation of Iraq and the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Just in terms of the relative balance of power, the fact that the United States is there with a military occupying force, but they're not settling, so you don't have that settler thing going on. The situation in Palestine is much more consistent with the kind of thesis, say, that Franz Fanon or someone wrote about when they were talking about the French in Algeria. The situation is slightly different with the Americans, but certainly there's some parallels right there. And they're faced with a situation of resistance similar to the Israelis, but the difference is the Americans are vastly outnumbered. And it's a logistical nightmare to just sustain the troops that they have over there right now. Israel is in the process of occupying someone that is literally a next-door neighbor. So, you know, and that matters. Distance matters. Geography matters. Familiarity matters. So the Israelis can be much more effective, but the reality is, I mean, do we want to be in a situation that's like Israel? I mean, Ariel Sharon has been ruthless since he's taken power this last time, and has he made Israel a more secure place? In fact, the number of attacks have gone up about tenfold. So if you set up an Israeli-like situation, you're going to end up with an Israeli-like situation, and we're getting some of that in Iraq. It occurs to me that openly copying Israeli tactics and openly taking military advice from the Israelis, another example of just the cultural cluelessness of Donald Rumsfeld and basically that administration. I just, you know, do they have any idea how that's perceived in Iraq? I don't think they do.
as if our challenges in Iraq aren't overwhelming enough, the U.S. also appears to, they're talking about having a spring offensive in Afghanistan and Pakistan. What's your take on that?
Yeah, if the Pakistanis go along, it's my understanding that, I guess the day before yesterday, the Pakistanis said that they would not permit the U.S. to operate inside Pakistan. You know, Musharraf had two attempts on his life not too long ago, and they were attempts that were made on him while he was in motion in his motorcade. Now, unless people are familiar with the kind of protective security that goes along with being a head of state or an ambassador or whatever, they might not immediately understand the implications of that. But the routes and itineraries of heads of state and ambassadors and other people who are under, who are operating with protective security details, are not known by anyone until very shortly before the routes are taken or very shortly before the itinerary is executed, and only by a limited number of people, which means that both these attacks were inside jobs. So there are people actually involved in Pakistani security who were involved in those attacks. Musharraf is in a situation where many members of his own intelligence service and many of the officers in his own military are very sympathetic to the form of Wahhabism that it was being taught in the madrasas in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and in the Pashtun areas of Afghanistan. They're sympathetic to that, and they're sympathetic to some of the political goals that are associated with that. So it's very politically risky for Musharraf to let the United States again violate the sovereignty of Pakistan in these cross-border operations coming out of Afghanistan. The spring offensive is being announced, with the intent. And when I hear him say, we're sure we're going to catch Osama bin Laden, I'm a little concerned about that, because it either tells me that they've got something up their sleeve or they're just blowing smoke again, because since September 11th, all the military operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, none of them have come out the way that they're supposed to come out. Most of them have been absolute military disasters that have been sort of spun back into military successes. The political outcomes have been bad, but I think the intent, if I understand it correctly, is that they want to capture Osama bin Laden. They need another boost in the polls, like the one that they got for like 3 weeks after they captured Saddam Hussein. They didn't capture Saddam Hussein. Most of the accounts that you get outside of the U.S. press indicate that he was captured by Kurdish militias and actually held for a little while so that they could bring him out and parade him around at a moment that was most politically advantageous. You know, I mean, that's what they do. They spin stories for a political purpose, the Jessica Lynch story, and, you know, all that fake rescue. And this has been the most stage-managed war in history. And that's saying something, because they're all stage-managed to some extent, you know, at least since the age of television. Yeah, I think that's what this spring offensive is about. I hope it's more successful than all the other offensives that they've had in Afghanistan. Not a single one of them has accomplished its intended purpose, not one. You know, the only thing they've accomplished is getting there. Now, they've got some bases that they're all sort of confined to, and there are battalion-sized Taliban elements walking around in the south of Afghanistan right now, unmolested, and basically preparing to vie for political power again. You know, and the only thing that they've got to fight them off with is a handful of people who are thugs themselves, and in many respects even worse than the Taliban, who are heroin traffickers. And Afghanistan has already resumed its place in the world as one of the premier heroin production zones in the world, and providing a significant amount of the heroin that's being consumed in Europe right now. The other place that was providing a good deal of the heroin that went into Europe was Kosovo, and the people who were providing it were gangsters who transformed themselves into the Kosovo Liberation Army, another allied army of the United States. But the United States government, in particular the Central Intelligence Agency, is attracted to drugs like a moth to a flame, because it sets up a situation where there's a lot of untraceable money in circulation, so you can do your covert operations with it.
Talk a bit about one of your critiques of the left is that they seem to be making the mistake of treating everyone in the military as a bunch of robotic killers.
Yeah, well, most generalizations are false, and shortcut thinking is a sure way to make mistakes, you know. The notion that you can generalize about the military is just as false as the notion that you can generalize about any group of a million people. You just can't. There are a diversity of reasons for going in the military, just like there's a diversity of reasons and histories that drive people to work for Walmart or IBM. And the people in the military are no more and no less a part of this system than people who work at Walmart or IBM. The military is not a freestanding institution. It's part of a larger system. If you think about this system as being a big building full of rooms, there's vacancies in certain rooms, and people fill those vacancies as they can, seeking the best opportunities that are available within the system. And a whole lot of military people that join the military because it's an economic decision. It's not totally an economic decision. Young people see these Madison Avenue Army of One things, and, you know, they sort of show people that are gaining technical mastery over some sort of a skill and having a sense of community and all these good things. And, you know, so the ad pitches work, and there's an element of that. But a lot of it is it's an easy way to get a job, to give you a regular check with good job security and health care and all that other stuff. There are white people and black people and people in between, and a few women, about 10-15% women, depending on which branch of the service that you're in right now. It's still predominantly a male institution, especially as you start looking at the people who are the real decision makers. And it's also an institution that's a reflection of the diversity of the overall society. It's probably slightly more conservative, but people tend to be, in many ways, more individualistic in the military than they are on the outside because they don't have the option of expressing their individuality through their appearance. And so they have to express their individuality sometimes in more substantial ways, like through their different avocations and interests and so forth. Because, you know, when you go in the military, as much as possible, they try to make us all look the same. They cut our hair and put us in the same clothes. So you never have that dilemma of what you're going to wear in the morning. In many ways, military culture has some positive aspects along with some negative aspects. These things aren't recognized by people on the left a lot of times. The inherent egalitarianism of many things in the military, the fact that people are provided for, though those benefits are now being rapidly eroded, and this administration's been attacking them with full force. It's not something you can just engage in shortcut thinking about, because you'll make a mistake. People should get to know people in the military. A lot more like them than they think they are.
Yeah, I believe you had said that a lot of the structure there was far more closer to socialism there on a military base than almost anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, and that's a very economistic form of socialism, and not one that everybody particularly wanted to participate in. But while I was in, I never had to worry about my kids going. My kids could go to a doctor anytime they wanted. They were in good schools with high-paid teachers. They had recreation centers that were available to them free, swimming pools, gymnasiums, parks. I had a check that was just as regular as rain. So, you know, those are the kind of things that keep people in the military, because that kind of security and the provision of those kinds of community commons are not available to most people on the outside. And I think progressive people politically in this country and people in the military have a lot more in common than what they realize. I've sort of made that my own little mission in life, is to build a bridge between those two. Because I'm both. I'm a former military, and I think I'm a leftist. So I think we need to understand each other a little better. At one point, when things get really, really bad, all those suits up in Washington are going to tell all those kids in those uniforms the enemy, and then they're going to have a decision to make. And I think we need to help them make the decision. And I'm not ready to say that those armed forces belong to the suits up in Washington. I'd rather forces belong to us. You know, that's the way I feel about it.